This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Reverend Michael Dowd checks in with Eco Radio KC in advance of his appearances at Wakarusa Wetlands and the All Souls Forum. But first, I'm Natural E with your headline news. E360.yale.edu reports the Trump administration has discontinued funding for NASA's Carbon Monitoring System, or CMS, a $10 million a year initiative that tracked greenhouse gas emissions from across the globe, according to Science Magazine. The program stitched together disparate satellite and aircraft measurements of CO2 and methane to create a cohesive look at the flow of carbon on Earth. Information vital to tracking national emissions levels. The White House had included the CMS in several proposed budget cuts to scientific research, but while Congress had previously fended off such cuts, a spending deal in March made no mention of CMS, which gave the administration the go-ahead to cancel the program, according to Steve Cole, a NASA spokesperson in Washington, D.C. The move allows existing grants to finish up, but does not support any new research. Since its start in 2010, the program has supported 65 research projects, including a comprehensive inventory of forest carbon stocks in Alaska, improved tropical forest carbon inventories, a look at dissolved carbon in the Mississippi River, and localized greenhouse gas emissions data for cities like Providence, Rhode Island. EurekaAlert.org reports new research reveals the growth of carbon production from Chinese exports has slowed or reversed, reflecting a new phase of globalization between developing countries that could undermine international efforts to reduce emissions. The study involving researchers from the University of East Anglia and colleagues in China and the United States investigated how complex supply chains are distributing energy-intensive industries and their CO2 emissions throughout the global South. It found that trade among developing nations, known as South-to-South trade, more than doubled between 2004 and 2011. Some production activities are relocating from China and India to other developing countries such as Indonesia, Vietnam, and Thailand, particularly for raw materials and intermediate goods production in energy-intensive sectors. In turn, the growth of CO2 emissions embodied in Chinese exports has slowed or reversed, while the emissions embodied in exports, such as textiles from less developed regions like Vietnam and Bangladesh, have surged. Majorities of Americans say the federal government is doing too little to protect key aspects of the environment, according to a new study released today by Pew Research Center. In a national survey of 2,541 U.S. adults, 69% of Americans say the federal government isn't doing enough to protect water quality of lakes, rivers, and streams, and 64% say the same about air quality. Two-thirds say the government is doing too little to reduce the effects of climate change. At the same time, the survey, conducted March 27th through April 9th of this year, found that Americans are closely divided over whether or not it is possible to cut back on regulations while still effectively protecting air and water quality. There is a wide political divide on this issue, with around three-quarters of Republicans convinced this is possible, but a majority of Democrats convinced it is not possible. And although large majorities of Americans, including majorities of both political parties, favor expanding solar and wind turbine facilities, the political divides over fossil fuels remain vast. To read the report, check out the link on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. And that's all for the news this evening. I'm going to welcome Mike Murphy to the mic to kick off the show.
Thank you very much, Naturally. Before we let you go, I understand this is going to be your last broadcast with Eco Radio KC. Is that right?
This is the one.
Wow.
That's a sad day, but
it is. We're very. It is a sad day. We really appreciate all you've done for us for the past several years. I mean, it's been amazing. We've been real blessed to have you here. So thank you very much for serving your community in a hopefully a meaningful way to you.
And you know this.
Thank you, Mike.
There's not enough I could ever say about what you have done for this show, and replacing you is impossible, but I appreciate everything that you've done. You took us to a whole new level, and that's going to be hard to change, but we'll miss you.
Well, I appreciate the kind words and the time spent with you also.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And don't be such a stranger. So
oh, I won't.
Again
to Naturally. We'll be back. I'll be back.
Yeah. Good deal. All right, well, we do have our guest on the line. It's Reverend Michael Dowd. and he promotes the epic of evolution as a sacred story and religious naturalism as its own religious orientation. We've got Richard Mabian here in the studio. So, Richard, we've got Reverend Dowd on the line. I'll let you you take it from here.
Hello, Reverend Dowd. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. Is this Richard I'm speaking to?
Yes, this is Richard you're speaking to. Let me give you a little fill-in on who I am so that it can help direct our conversation. There's two things. One, I'm a board member for the Kansas Sierra Club, so that puts me in the ballpark as far as environmentalism is concerned. But I'm also the president of the Kansas City, Kansas NAACP. So that brings another dimension into the work that you're doing. And I think it's real timely that you're coming on when you are, because I just stumbled up on the word eco-theology. And I had been standing around and telling folks that it was the missing link in a lot of the work that I've been doing. So to hear you, and even though your wordage that you're using about what you're doing are a little different, can you kind of give us just a elevator pitch on what it is that you're actually involved in?
Sure. My wife, Connie Barlow, is a science writer, and she's written four science books, all with mainstream science publishers. She's also a climate activist, and I'm a minister, and we've been traveling North America for the last 16 years, speaking in churches and colleges and synagogues, basically about 2,500 groups over the last 16 years. And what we speak about is where science, inspiration, and sustainability meet. Like at that intersection is what all of our programs are on. And so evolution and ecology, both of those disciplines I see as sacred or holy or deeply inspiring. I even call them revelatory, that basically God, and I use the word God and reality interchangeably. I could say that reality is God's secular name and God is reality's sacred name or mythic name. That reality, God, has been revealing some amazing things through science, but to use religious language, we haven't been giving God glory for that. We haven't honored the divine for all the knowledge that we have. We've been thinking of, most religious people have been thinking of that just as secular. And so there's a lot that we've learned that's been revealed to us about what we need to do to live in right relationship to the air, the water, the soil, and the life upon which we and our grandchildren depend. So my message is very much pro-future and pro-science, and I try to show the sacred side of science, the deeply meaningful and inspiring aspects of what's being revealed evidentially through scientific evidence, historic evidence, and cross-cultural evidence, all with the mindset or with the goal of trying to help people to embrace and be prepared for what's coming down the pike, but also to do whatever they can to help ensure a just, healthy, and sustainably life-giving future.
You know, basically what you're saying is exactly what got me involved in the movement to begin with. And so since I'm a person of color, I'll base my comments from that perspective. I knew for a fact going into this environmental movement. In fact, the first two conferences that I ever attended starting in 2007, early 2007 with David Corton. I'm not for sure if you're familiar with him or not.
Oh, yes, of course.
I was at his initial navigation conference that he held up in Columbus, Ohio. And the thing I met when I walked in the door, that out of a couple hundred people, there were probably five people of color and two of us being black. When I tell the story, I said, and the other guy that was there didn't even speak to me for the whole first day, the other black guy. So it kind of puts you in a world of your own. And it was that isolation that I had, because no one even stopped to speak, is what caused David Corton and I to bond as people. Then he invited me to a conference out at Berkeley. That was my second one, and that was with BALE, Business Alliance for Local Living Economy. And that one had about 700 people, and it was probably about, again, 20 people of color with maybe five of us being black. So yeah. My involvement in the environmental movement, in fact, I have a video from that night when I ended up getting up on the stage in the opening exercise and said that I wanted to make the lack of people of color in the environmental movement my national contribution to the environmental world. So that's kind of what brought me into it. Well, it wasn't long. In fact, we started a conference here. Now, this is not my interview, but I want you to understand where this, where we dissect or connect. When I started the environmental conference, it didn't take me long to start realizing a big thing that was missing is that when you deal with people of color, that there's a profound love for God. And, you know, I think I had probably had the first environmental conference in this nation that opened up with a prayer. I mean, they still don't do that. I go to environmental meetings. They don't open up with prayers. I mean, that's the furthest thing from being associated with it. Well, if you're going to deal with people of color and people of color have God as a foundation, then it would make sense to me that for you to be able to reach them environmentally, that's an area that had to be addressed.
Absolutely.
So that's what got me in, and that's basically what I hear you saying, how those two worlds do not connect. I mean, I have some really great scientists, white scientists that I love to death, that have been very beneficial in teaching me about this environmental movement and this environmental world. But spirituality is not a part of their existence.
Right, right. Okay. Well, and another issue also is that many environmentalists have not made the connection to justice issues. And if you're not dealing with both social justice and generational justice, then you're going to be basically not speaking to the heart of what's really the concerns of many people of color and many indigenous people. And so I think I agree with you. We need to bring the spirituality component, or at least that's what I do,
right.
But also the intergenerational justice and social justice aspects.
Oh, I love that. I love you saying that. I have a rabbi who was working with us and that works with us in the Kansas area, the whole state. He's with the, interfaith groups, you know, the interfaith.
Yep.
And he has backed out some because he is more conscious about social justice than he is the environmental justice. And now when he speaks, he does that. Many times he and I will be the two that are bond in the meeting because of our social justice concerns. He's helped me understand that because I have been driven with the environmental concerns, and really it comes back to the social justice that needs to be worked in with the environmental justice.
Exactly. And the issue of language is an important one, and not too many people think it through very deeply. I don't even call myself an environmentalist, because what we call the environment is actually primary reality. It's God's local self. It's the living, pulsing presence of the biosphere that we will either live in right relationship to or we will perish. And so thinking of primary reality, the living world, the air, water, soil, and the life that is required for us to even exist, thinking of that as merely the environment, little e, is getting off to the wrong foot right at the start, because it leads us to think of primary reality not as primary, not as a vow that needs to be honored and respected and have a humble relationship to, but we start thinking of it as an it that we can exploit and use for our benefit, and that's suicidal. That's self-terminating. We don't have any examples of sustainable cultures, that is, cultures that could live for hundreds and thousands of years without diminishing and destroying primary realities. We don't have any examples of those that didn't treat primary reality, the living world, as primary, and honor that.
Well, now, if you ask me, and I don't want to make it all on one side, because I think on the spiritual side, if I may, I'll talk about my ministers, especially in the inner cities. They are basically missing in action. And their reasons for getting involved would be more about seeking some kind of grant than it would be the profoundness of what this environmental movement is supposed to be teaching. So we have that side of the coin that we have to deal with also. And I have, when I stumble up on the word of eco-theology, and that came about because my local Catholic charity college asked me to come speak to their, it's an inner city college, to speak to their students. And they wanted me to have them, one of the students, to tell me what they've learned about environmental ethics. And so I went and looked it up because I figured if I had to listen to what they had learned, I better know what I was talking about when I went in there. When I looked it up, that's where I stumbled up on the term environmental theology. And it just blew me away because I knew as soon as I saw it what it was. Now, it talked about content. It talked about, I've been reading so much on it, so it's just different areas. But it talked about how are a lot of those ministers, those inner city ministers, those black ministers, are still dealing with things from the biblical day concepts and how the content in the whole spiritual world has evolved. You know, we're not the same spiritual beings that we were in Genesis. Yes, right, exactly. Theology, theology-wise, yes, because I brought this to my church the very first Sunday, in the Sunday school class, and immediately they thought I was talking about theology. Not theology-wise, more content, you know, how we dealing with people.
Right. Well, it's not just inner-city ministers, but I know dozens of white ministers, probably hundreds of white ministers that are also... I sometimes say religion is asleep at the wheel. Religion has not been... doing the one thing that religions have always done in sustainable cultures that that honor God, basically, that honor primary reality, that, you know, to use religious language, you know, for 97% of human history, we lived in the garden. We walked intimately with God, with reality, and we didn't despoil the air, water, soil, and the life upon which we depended. That's only been happening for the last 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years. City-based cultures overshoot the carrying capacity, and so that's why I love eco-theology, and I call myself an eco-theist.
Yes, I saw that. You had a different term that you used.
Yeah, and part of it is because if religion is doing its job, it never allows the present to be it never allows the future to be sacrificed by the present. And we've got a situation where we've got an economic system that benefits the few at the expense of the many, measures progress by how fast we can turn the biosphere into pollution, and forces millions of us to betray the future just by pursuing the so-called good life. Religion is failing at its most fundamental task, which is ensuring that the future is not compromised by the present. I sometimes say that acting in the present moment with the seventh generation in mind, as indigenous cultures did, isn't just a good idea. To do otherwise is evil. And so I'm trying to... my message to religious people, basically, is that I think religion needs to have a born-again experience. Religion needs to be saved, that is, to come back home to God, to reality, and start speaking on behalf of the future as our sacred responsibility.
Well, you know, many of those folks who I'm talking about that don't embrace the spiritual way of life are really good people. You know, I'll probably get hit in the head. I'll probably get talked about like Trump did when he said them folks down there in the marches where there were some good people in there. Folks don't understand exactly where that's coming from. But they're really good people, and most of them have been driven to the point they are because of the misuse of spirituality, and they get to a point of saying what they do, like you just heard me say, is seeing ministers that are hustling more for grants and their own well-being than they are the care of people. So I agree, but at the same time, that's a vision of what I'm having to work with in the inner city, people who are just disenfranchised and just have just thrown their hands hands up and don't feel that there's any reason to even have any faith in this world that we live. Mike and I were talking before. I got to take a break here, but when we come back, I want to talk about the difference between stewardship and dominion. Okay, can we, if we can do that?
Sure.
All right, we'll be right back in just a second, sir.
All right, before we go to break, I do want to let our listeners know that Reverend Dowd will be in Lawrence on Friday evening at the Wakarusa Wetlands Discovery Center, which is at 1365 North 1250 Road in Lawrence, Kansas. And the Sustainability Action Network is bringing him there. On Saturday, he will be at the Troost Fest from 1 to 3, and that's on Troost Avenue between 31st and Linwood, a big festival that lasts all day celebrating Troost, which is historically a racial divide in Kansas City, Missouri. And then Reverend Dowd will be the featured speaker at the All Souls Forum on Sunday at All Souls UU Church. And then before one other thing before we go to break, if anyone wants to join the conversation,
yes,
the number to call is 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-5534. We'll be back with Reverend Michael Dowd and Richard Mabian after this.
Reverend Norma Gann never felt like she fully fit in the male or female roles emphasized in her Christian upbringing, but she discovered her true gender identity through her Native American heritage.
It destroyed the boundaries that I was raised with, and yet at the same time it set me free, so free.
We learn what it means to be Two-Spirit on the next Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right after Link's Mix.
On the next alternative radio, Tariq Ali.
And the one thing I have learned over the last 50 years is that one must not give up. You know, that's the worst possible thing, is to give up because things seem bad. We have to fight back with every means possible and carry on and help those who are fighting back and speak on behalf of those who can't.
Wednesday, 9 a.m.
Nitrates in rural wells on this current cast. Nitrate is a natural chemical compound present in almost all water. But high levels in fertilizer runoff, septic discharges, or animal waste can leach into groundwater. If it gets into drinking water, it puts infants at risk for blue baby syndrome, a condition preventing them from getting enough oxygen. Brian Swistock of Penn State Extension says nitrate is not absorbed through the skin.
You can shower in the water.
But if levels are high, use bottled water for drinking and cooking. Nitrate has no smell or taste, so the only way to know if you have a problem is to have your well tested. Boiling does not help, so water treatment may be the only solution if you have nitrate in your water. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and I'm sitting here talking to a doctor, a Reverend Dow, who is from my perspective, I'm calling him an ego theologist, but he's really he considers himself an evolutionary evangelist. He is a minister, and he travels around and has been speaking, I think he said something like 2,500 people, about this subject that deals with the environment from a spiritual and religious term. Dr. Dow, my brother is a pastor, and he does a lot of dispelling the term religion. He spends more time speaking in terms of spirituality. He, along with a growing group of people who are like him, again, multiculturally, feel that religion has become a commercial kind of a process.
Yes.
And that is what people have been turned off on. But when they deal with the spiritual aspect of it, it becomes real. I said before when we took the break that I wanted to address that topic of dominion and then also stewardship. because I think there's a difference involved. When Mike and I were talking about it before we came on the air, he was speaking in terms that people who see that word dominion using in the sense that they can do whatever they want to the animal, to the land, to whatever, because God gave them permission to do that. And in many ways, that's how it's being used. But then again, dealing with that, we see that that also has a flip side to it. And that's kind of where you're coming from. Yes, God did give us dominion over this land, but it wasn't to degrade it. It wasn't to do the degradation. Where are you on that particular subject?
Well, I actually think that it goes even deeper than stewardship, because the fundamental issue is one of idolatry. And idolatry, I don't mean bowing down to statues, and I don't mean believing in the wrong God. Human-centeredness is idolatry. And there are ways of thinking of stewardship and our relationship to primary reality, that is the living world upon which we depend utterly, like God's local presence, you could say, that are filled with hubris, that are filled with arrogance, and that's suicidal, that humanity can't survive. Our species will go extinct if we continue having, as we have now for quite some time, this arrogant way of relating, human-centered way of relating. So we measure progress and success, for example, in human-centered terms, gross domestic product or gross national product. What we need to do, and we need to do it as soon as possible, is begin measuring success and progress in life-centered terms. That is, how well is the soil doing decade by decade? How well is the forest doing decade by decade? What's the carbon parts per million in the atmosphere decade by decade? The other species. See, human-centeredness is self-terminating. That's why it must be seen as idolatry. So any theology in the future will embrace ecology at its heart. And I think one of the big problems in the religious communities these days, of all colors, is that religion is stuck in idolatry of the written word, idolatry of the otherworldly, and idolatry of beliefs. I call them the triple idolatries. Idolatry of the written word, meaning that where we think God's best guidance, that is our best map of reality, is frozen in time in some ancient text, rather than honoring God's evidential revelation. That is, all the things that God's been revealing through evidence over the last 500 years. And idolatry of the otherworldly is where we think God, where God resides, that is where ultimate reality or primary reality resides, is only outside time and nature, rather than also incarnate and expressed and revealed in time and nature. And then finally, idolatry of beliefs is where we privilege beliefs, and we think religion is all about beliefs and having the right beliefs over knowledge. We should be honoring reality, honoring God for all the knowledge that we have, because that is going to be the only thing that helps us humble ourselves and come home like the prodigal species. You know, we've squandered our inheritance, and we're waking up to our predicament, this pig pen, as it were, and we're going to be forced to come home to God, or we're going to go extinct, one or the other. And so that's part of the gospel message that I'm carrying, is honoring evidence as modern-day scripture, honoring ecology as the heart of theology, and honoring reality as God's secular name.
Okay. Reverend Dow, we have a person that's called in online. Caller, you're on the air now. Can you give me your first name and the part of the city you're calling from, please?
Well, the acronym I go by is Blind Guy, and I'm calling from Midtown, Kansas City, 3 blocks west of Coos. Anyway, how are you, Richard?
Doing just fine, Blind Guy. It's been a little while since I've heard you.
Yeah, well, you usually act like you don't even know me. Look at how long I've known you. But anyway, I have knock, knock.
Yes, sir.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Jesus.
Yes, sir. Jesus who?
Richard, maybe you don't know Jesus?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. I you had me nervous. You know that, don't you, Blind Guy? I know you said peace out and you're gone, but that's good. Thank you for calling in, and thank you for giving the respect that you just did to both me and Reverend Dow, which is exactly what he was saying before I took your call. And that spiel that he gave, he was talking about the respect that we as people need to give, and I feel that a whole lot. I know that that the, like you said, is much deeper, Reverend Dow, than the stewardship part of it. But you know, one of the things I have to be concerned about, I deal with a lot of intellectuals. I deal with a lot of academic-minded people that speak in academic terms. But I also deal with real people. Now, not to say that those other people aren't real, if you understand what I'm talking about.
Right, exactly.
And the interpretation is really important. I spend a lot of my time interpreting what I see happening in life. An example, and I had to do this today, so it's real, and I'll bring it to you what I'm saying about how your particulars, how this eco-theology is explaining it to others. I saw a program on TV yesterday, a science program called 2050, where these two electrical engineers had got together. Thank God one of them was black. I was almost shocked out of my room when I looked up and saw this young black guy in there with this young white guy. And they were they had figured out a way to use sound to put out fires. And that was very amazing. And they sit there with this little contraption they'd fixed in their hand, and they'd start a fire in a bowl. And when the fire was stumming in a big bowl, and when the fire would blaze up, they would turn on this machine with sound waves, and the sound waves would put the fire out. You know,
wow,
and
I sat there.
Oh, I sat there going, this is amazing. As far as, first of all, this is what I'm teaching my particular portion of the population. I'm going, if we don't teach our kids to love science and technology, when they grow up, they'll be unemployable. So seeing something like that was a value to me. But then they came back home and they showed how in the future, when you're having these wildfires and forest fires and burning up all like is going on in California and Arizona and those different places, what they will end up being able to do is to send in drones, hundreds of drones that will be able to fly over the air, the area, emit sound, and put the fire out.
Well, I hope you're right, because that's very exciting. I've never heard of that.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, but wait, before you go. Now, that was the initial response. But my response was, that means we're eliminating firemen. So it became an employment issue. Now, when I'm dealing with my portion of the population to explain why we need to be doing things to teach our kids to love science and technology because of future employment possibilities. See, one of the drawbacks is, oh, he could always be a fireman. He can always be a policeman.
Well,
and I'm saying
that
the technology, the way it's going, could very easily eliminate those jobs. I'm sorry. I wanted to make sure I got that out there.
I'm just not sure about that. I mean, I don't know about this technology you're talking about, but I, given a drier world, given a heating climate, I can't imagine that firefighters aren't going to be needed for the long haul. We just watched last week the movie Only the Brave, which is one of the best movies I've ever seen. It's about the 19 firefighters in Prescott, Arizona, the Granite Mountain hotshots that were killed just a week after they saved a 2,000-year-old alligator juniper tree, and 19 of them died. It's a fabulous movie, Only the Brave. Highly recommend it.
Okay. Well, I'm saying, granted, I agree with you. It would be very hard for people to see that. But, you know, those of us who are in the industry realize it's possible. I mean, you know, when you you got robots flipping burgers.
No, exactly. You're pointing to something that's absolutely crucial, which is that, you know, typically when robots and machines take over for humans, not only does it cause a lot of people to get out of work, but it benefits the owners, but it's not benefiting the people. Fortunately, we're going to be seeing a declining of quality of energy. Because we're post peak of conventional oil, I don't see many more decades of this techno fetish religion of everlasting growth. It doesn't have a future. But you're right, in the short run, it's causing a lot of people to be out of work at some of these technologies, and it's scary.
Well, when I read Thomas Friedman's book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, he spoke in there that what really should be going on in this world right now is a green revolution. But, you know, we're doomsday kind of people. We don't react until it's on us. I mean, 9/11, I mean, you know, for about 30 days after 9/11, 6 months after 9/11, all the churches in New York were full. But as people realized it wasn't getting ready to happen again, everybody went back to their normal way of living. So I'm saying, you know, we need, that's what I'm doing at my particular level, because eventually it's going to hit where at the other levels, the emphasis that needs to be going into this green way of thinking is going to become a front burner issue.
I completely agree, and that's one of the reasons why I wear a green clergy shirt. I started the last few years wearing a green clergy shirt because my commitment is to the greening of religion and the greening of spirituality.
Okay, well, and that's what's really good about what we're doing, because one thing David Corton emphasized that I use in most of my presentation is that for the green of this planet to work, it's going to have to be inclusive of everyone.
So, absolutely.
So even when we don't agree with what people are doing or saying or how they're living, those people are going to have to be green-minded too. And if we're at this juncture at what should be considered the learning phase, the academic phase, the education phase of that green movement, then that means each and every group of individuals in this nation need to have someone within their peer group doing and talking about what it's required of them to be involved in the greening of this planet too.
Absolutely. And the first and most important thing that needs to be greened is our economy. Any economy that doesn't mimic the wisdom of God's nature, the wisdom of ecology, is betraying the future. We have to mimic the wisdom of the living world, because there's an economy that it's God's economy. It's the economy of the living world, and everything that needs to be recycled as close to 100% as possible, and energy needs to be conserved as much as possible. That's why old growth forests and healthy ecosystems are sustainable, because they recycle the idea that we humans can create things that can't be used as food by some other organism is crazy. It's insane. We have to fundamentally shift how we do so many things. So it's a big task, but fortunately, we're going to have no shortage of problems in the coming years and decades because of the fact that we have dishonored the living world for so long that there are now consequences. I like a quote from Robert Louis Stevenson. He says, sooner or later, we all sit down to a banquet of consequences.
I know that's right.
And we're going to have those in spades. And fortunately, or hopefully, we will humble ourselves, shift out of human-centeredness to life-centeredness, to primary reality, and start measuring success in life-centered ways, because that's our only hope of not betraying the future.
All right, Reverend Dow, we're going to take another break here. Before we go, I want to give out the number again to anyone out there listening that maybe want to jump on the line and have a comment with us. That's 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534.
Also, just a reminder of Reverend Dow is going to be here in our listening area. He's got a few engagements on Friday night. He'll be... The Sustainability Action Network is bringing him to the Wakarusa Wetlands Discovery Center, which is at 1365 North 1250 Road in Lawrence, Kansas. On Saturday, he'll be at the Troost Fest between 1 and 3, and that's on Troost between 31st and Linwood. And then on Sunday, he'll be speaking at the All Souls Forum at All Souls Church in Kansas City. So again, the number to call is 816-931-5534. If you want to join this conversation, the time is running out. This is the time to call.
Land ownership seems to be a fairly cut and dried concept. If I buy the land, then I own the land. But on this week's All Souls Forum, Amy Adamson explains that when it comes to the oil industry in Kansas, somebody besides yourself may own the rights to what's under the very house you live in. And should they want to build a road, cut down your trees, or install a pump jack outside your front door, their rights may trump yours. Join us Wednesday evenings at 6 p.m. here on 90.1 FM KKFI.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we look at upcoming changes and how people in Kansas City get around. What's the latest on naming something after Martin Luther King? What is bus rapid transit? Will streetcar expansion be good for Westport? Will it even happen? We'll spend the hour discussing why these issues are important for workers in the metro area. Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Florida Everglades are not just home to gators, snowy egrets, and panthers. The Everglades provide South Florida with clean drinking water. For centuries, fresh water moved slowly through the wetlands towards Florida Bay. But to make way for development, much of the region was drained. The Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan aims to restore a natural flow of fresh water. But Shamelis Desu of Florida International University says the decades-old plan ignores a key factor, rising seas.
We have shown that sea level rise is an important and big piece of restoring the Everglades. And to address that, the sea level has to be included as a major component in the decision process.
Desu says that as seas rise, salt water enters freshwater marshes. That can kill sawgrass, allow salt-loving mangroves to move inland, and impair the ecosystem. Restoration managers can counteract rising salinity by directing more fresh water onto the landscape. So Desu says they must consider sea level rise when planning and executing projects.
What happens in the future depends on what we do today.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And we're back with Reverend Michael Dowd and Richard Mabian, and we do have a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Rosa, and I'm calling from Midtown.
Okay. What can we do for you, Rosa?
Well, I just tuned in about 10, 15 minutes ago, so I didn't hear the previous part of the conversation. But I was wondering if, when talking about greening the economy, if we started talking about the issues with capitalism and living in a world that prioritizes profit over, you know, the planet and our lives and world peace, really.
I completely agree. Capitalism and communism, interestingly enough, were both, at least in their current forms and in their forms of the 20th century, both of them were human-centered, and both of them were destructive of the living world, the primary reality. But I completely agree, placing profits. I mean, the fact that we allow individuals and corporations to get wealthy in ways that diminish or destroy the future is crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
Well, you know...
There's a growing eco-socialist movement that is critical of, you know, the past communist movements aren't they're so problematic and with, you know, industrialization and everything, but seeing how the whole ecosystem is connected, I think that there's a lot of hope and people seeing the intersections between environmental degradation and the, you know, militarization of the police and racism in our communities. Yeah. It's giving me a lot of hope.
Well, you know, if you go back to David Corton again, the book that really gave him his world prominence was the one that he wrote on when corporations ruled the world.
Yeah.
And it was really directed toward what we're talking about right now. I was wondering, Reverend Dowd, you know, if we talk in terms of morality, because that's where we're headed, you know that. If we start finding ways to go from them and us, or the issues that cause the debates for back and forth, and start dealing with the love for self and others, and deal with it from that social justice frame, do you think that would have a potential roadmap to it, an ending, or heading us in a new direction?
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought up the term morality, because it really is. It's an issue of deep ethics. Mm-hmm. It's an issue of primary morality. And we have an economic system and a political system that's totally unsustainable. And so this is where I'm trying to wake up religions and churches and other religious organizations, as well as secular groups. I actually have spoken to about 2,500 groups. I've spoken to hundreds of thousands of people over the last 16 years. And what does give me hope is that people across the religious and philosophical spectrum are hungering, in my experience, literally from atheists to evangelicals and everything in between. There's a lot of people, tens of millions of people, as best I can tell, who are really hungering for a deep green message, a deep green, a coming home to primary reality, the living world is primary, and coming home to that there's nothing more important than being pro-future. That is being, we can no longer allow anti-future practices, anti-future politics, anti-future economics, anti-future religion. I mean, this is the thing. A lot of religious people have this idea that they interpret the second coming of Christ in this otherworldly way, like Jesus is going to come down on the clouds. So who cares about climate change? You know, if you believe that the end of the world is going to happen in the next couple decades, then who cares about what things are going to be like 100 years from now for the rest of the body of life? And so people's religious beliefs are part of the problem, at least some kind of religious beliefs are.
Okay,
Rose.
Rose, if you're still on, I want to thank you for calling, and we'll move on. I appreciate your call.
All right, thank you so much for the discussion.
Yes, ma'am. One thing I wanted to come back to you with before we run out of town here, we got about a good 4 minutes to go, Ramdale, is you speak in terms of speaking to these groups of people. I'd like to know what kind of feeling you're getting from their reception of what your receptiveness of what you're speaking to them about, and what kind of pushback do you get?
Yeah, one of the things that's been really gratifying, Richard, is that because I get a chance to speak to so many different kinds of religious and secular groups, but I always speak about the intersection of science, inspiration, and sustainability. And so, for example, some years ago, I spoke at the United Nations a program titled Evolution and the Global Integrity Crisis. And by integrity, I mean right relationship to reality. So Evolution and the Global Integrity Crisis. So I delivered that for the Values Caucus at the United Nations. And then a couple months later, Michael Shermer at Skeptic Magazine wanted me to deliver that exact same program to a group of 350 scientists, many of them humanists and atheists, in Caltech. A week later, exactly a week later, I delivered that same program. I didn't change a single slide at Michael Beckwith's Agape Spiritual Life Center, which is a sort of a New Age mecca. And then 3 weeks after that, it was at a Catholic church, and 2 weeks after that, in an evangelical church. That was the exact same program, but evangelicals, atheists, New Agers, and Catholics are totally different populations, and yet the exact same program worked, because we used to hand out feedback forms, and I know that about 85 to 90% of the people loved my program. And so I that gives me hope that people are really hungering for this ecology is the heart of theology message.
Okay. I agree with you that on the fact that people are looking. I range from the bottom to the top. And on the bottom, I'm always quite amazed that when I find that people are desperately looking for something. Right now, they have a tendency to be critical of leadership. And
right.
I, like you, spend a lot of my time dealing with individual responsibility. Not about having to have a person standing up here on a soapbox telling you what you can and cannot
exactly.
do or should or should not do. It's what you yourself become, and that's where my stewardship becomes an issue, especially with the spiritual community. Sir, we got about a minute left, and I wanted you to I want to make sure Mike comes in. Hang on, in fact, I have Mike do that. Nice talking to you, sir.
Right. I just wanted to make sure we know the speaking engagements again. So we're on Friday night at 7 o'clock at Wakarusa Wetlands Discovery Center, Saturday afternoon at the Truth Fest, and Sunday morning at All Souls Forum. And you can find out more at sustainabilityaction.net. And then also, Reverend Dowd, is there a website you want to give our listeners?
Sure. The two main websites, one is thegreatstory.org, thegreatstory.org, and then just michaeldowd.org.
Okay, that's great. That's great. And we can't thank you enough for joining us. This has been a great discussion. We really appreciate your wisdom.
I hope I get a chance to see you while you're in town, sir. You sound like you're a very interesting person.
If you do, Richard, please make sure you introduce yourself.
Oh, you know I will. If I get anywhere close to you, I'll start yelling if I'm in the back of the room.
That sounds good. And thank you, Mike. Thank you for making this up.
All right. Thank you. All right, we're going to go to Natural E. She pre-recorded the her last calendar of events, and then we'll go into This Week in Water. And do stay tuned for Fiesta Musical.
On May 19th from 3:30 p.m. to 5 p.m., meet two local experts on insects and spiders at Love Bugs, a citizen science event, and learn how to be a citizen science of these often maligned creatures. Insects and spiders are foundational to ecology. At this event, Betsy Betros and Linda Williams will share their experiences with studying, cataloging, and photographing insects and using online photo databases to share findings and learn from others. Greenworks will host the presentation from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, May 19th at 607 East 31st Street in Kansas City, Missouri. Lawrence Electronic Recycling Event is May 19th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. You can help keep toxic materials out of the landfill by recycling your old computers and e-waste at the Electronics Recycling Event in Lawrence, Kansas, this coming Saturday, May 19th. The City of Lawrence Solid Waste Division will host the spring from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the University of Kansas Park and Ride East parking lot at Clinton Parkway and Crestline Drive. There is a recycling fee for CRT televisions, but there is no recycling fee for other electronic equipment, and fees are accepted in cash only. Items not accepted at this event include large appliances and Freon-containing items such as refrigerators, dehumidifiers, and household hazardous wastes such as paint, pesticides, compressed gas cylinders, smoke and carbon monoxide detectors, and fluorescent light bulbs. You can find more information by checking out the link on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. Thursday, May 24th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Californo's, Green Drinks KC hosts an event where you can learn about a new service in Kansas City offering curbside compost pickup. This is a chance to keep from tossing food waste or wearing out your disposal. Compost Collective will speak about how they got started and how their service works. For those who cannot compost on their own, it's an opportunity to reduce waste. And be sure to tune in to All Souls Forum this Wednesday at 6 p.m. to hear private property rights and oil and gas industry incursions with Amy Adamson. Amy Adamson is a concerned citizen and landowner near Baldwin City, Kansas. She'll discuss dilemmas over conflicts between landowners, the Kansas Corporation Commission, surface rights holders, and oil and gas drillers. That's this Wednesday at 6 p.m. right here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio.
During droughts, these pests will bite you more. That story and others on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. Geological Survey in Hawaii is warning that there could be massive eruptions of the Kilauea volcano in coming weeks after it first exploded on May 3rd.
Lava continues to sink inside the volcanic crater, and an influx of groundwater could lead to steam explosions launching ballistic projectiles as small as a pebble or as big as a car.
Ash clouds may rise to higher elevations and spread over larger areas. CNN reports that new vents on the ground miles east of the Kilauea summit have released slow-moving lava and toxic gas into communities.
Should winds weaken, the gases can combine with moisture to create volcanic smog or VOG, containing acid droplets that can cause respiratory problems.
If precipitation occurs, the result will be acid rain with the corrosive properties of diluted battery acid, which can damage plants, cars, and buildings.
Some people on the island use catchment systems for their water, and officials are warning that they could be polluted from the ash in the air.
About 2,000 people have been forced to evacuate due to the lava flows, and about 24 homes have been destroyed.
Recently, a candidate for governor in Colorado offered a possible solution to the projected gap between the state's water supply and demand. His answer? beavers.
There were some chuckles when he did so. The idea that beavers could solve what some project as a huge water deficit may seem odd at best.
But beavers could have a role in water quality issues, if not closing quantity gaps.
A recent study published in the journal Earth Processes and Landforms shows that beaver dams are natural filters for waterways. They can help stem the loss of valuable soils from farms and clean up polluted rivers and streams.
A single family of the critters at a research site covering about 6 acres built 13 dams and created a series of deep ponds along a small stream.
The scientists learned that the beaver ponds trapped sediment with high concentrations of phosphorus and nitrogen, usually coming from fertilizers, that can pollute human and wildlife water supplies.
The study was done in England, where beavers were thought to have been extinct until about 10 years ago, when a colony was discovered in Scotland.
Urban areas are losing something important for water and air quality, trees.
About 36 million trees in the U.S. are lost each year, according to a study from the Forest Service. Trees help reduce carbon emissions and can save energy around buildings by reducing the need for air conditioning. They also warm buildings by lowering wind pressure in colder months.
But as new roads and buildings are created, they increase impervious surfaces, and nearly 200,000 acres of tree cover are lost annually.
One of the scientists involved in the study told Popular Science that the value of trees in urban areas is more important than those in rural forests because they're closer to people.
Most people think that mosquitoes bite to get food from human blood, but according to a report from the University of Cincinnati, they also bite because they're thirsty.
Mosquitoes use meals of blood to replace the water they've lost, and they may transmit diseases like West Nile virus more frequently when it's dry, according to the researchers.
The insects seem to be more threatening after rains, when they lay eggs in standing water. However, the new research shows that dry conditions don't provide protection.
The study found that dehydrated conditions did not reduce activity and increased the propensity of mosquitoes to land and feed on a host.
Among animals, mosquitoes pose the deadliest threat to humans because of the diseases they spread, like malaria, which by itself kills about 400,000 people a year.
It doesn't take long for a mosquito to get dehydrated. They get thirsty within 2 to 3 hours in high temperatures and low humidity.
The flow of the Colorado River is expected to peak at the Utah-Colorado border Sunday, May 13th, which is quite early in the year.
According to the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel, this would be the third earliest peak flow from snowmelt runoff that supplies water to much of the Southwest.
While the peak is occurring early, the amount of water in the river is low. According to records from the Colorado River Conservation District, this year may be the fourth lowest in 85 years.
Forecasters are predicting that Lake Powell above Glen Canyon Dam will receive only about 40% of its long-term average.
But comparing what's happening to average years may be misleading, as H2O Radio has reported earlier.
According to a white paper from the Colorado River Research Group, the Southwest is entering a period of aridification in which drier conditions persist, instead of a drought with a distinct end. And finally, people have used plants and animals to understand the environment for years. They're called bioindicators. Think canaries in mine shafts to detect gases. There are numerous examples.
Lichens are often used to assess air quality, since they don't have roots and get a lot of their nutrients from the atmosphere. Plants were used after the Chernobyl disaster to analyze soils after the nuclear meltdown. And a team of scientists in Copenhagen used a plant whose leaves changed from green to red when exposed to nitrogen dioxide gas in order to detect landmines.
Now, a researcher from Colorado State University is studying how bats locate usable water sources and detect its quality. Teresa Laverty spent 18 months in Namibia observing bats in the desert.
In this extreme arid region, freshwater pools are rare and rivers flow intermittently, so it can be hard for wildlife to find water. But because bats fly, they can find freshwater sources over large areas and may visit multiple ponds in a single night.
They're also picky. Laverty observed that bat activity was lower at springs with high salt concentrations. So by tracking the animals, people could could locate high-quality water.
Water quality challenges aren't limited to African deserts. Groundwater pumping in many areas of the world is degrading aquifers, making them saltier, and road salts have affected freshwater bodies across the U.S.
About a third of bat species are endangered worldwide, all the more reason to protect them and follow their activity. A new kind of bat signal, perhaps? This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
Thanks for listening to EcoRadio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.